how do you really know what's true when you're faced with these incredibly complex historical debates, especially religious ones where belief is so central?
It's a tough question. It really forces you to look at how knowledge is, well, passed down or even created.
Exactly. And today we're diving into a controversy that's ancient, but honestly, it feels surprisingly relevant. It really touches the nature of wisdom, tradition, and belief itself.
That's right. Our goal today is to take a critical look at certain teachings, often called New Kabbalah.
Yeah.
We're focusing particularly on the concepts of Sephiro divine emanations and Partsufin, these divine countenances.
These are key ideas in the critiques we'll explore.
Absolutely central.
And our main source for this deep dive is a pretty powerful article by Chaim Shalov. The title's in Hebrew, but it essentially translates to critiques of the lies and vanities of the New Kabbalah, focusing on Sephiro as distortion and heresy and the blasphemy towards the sages.
And crucially, the article centers on the arguments of Rabbi Shlomo ben Shimon Duran, known as the Rash Bash.
Right. So we're setting the stage here. We're going to unpack these historical arguments, really look at the core disagreements, and try to understand what this whole debate, centuries old, tells us about, you know, authenticity, knowledge, and belief today.
Let's start with the main figure here, Rabbi Shlomo ben Shimon Duran, the Rash Bash. He was a major rabbi, significant legal decisor based in Algeria, a really important voice.
And the article says he courageously revealed something pretty startling.
Yes, his concern was that this new Torah, which people were calling Kabbalah, was, and this is his phrase, very foreign to the people of Israel. A strong statement.
And the author of the article we're using, James Shalov, he clearly aligns himself strongly with the Rash Bash. He says he's committed to uprooting idolatry, restoring God's true unity. And he even says he's now opening a box locked for hundreds of years by talking about this more openly. That suggests a real conviction, doesn't it?
It certainly does. A sense of urgency, perhaps.
Yeah.
So moving to the Rash Bash's actual objections, his primary claim was that this new Kabbalah was basically an invention.
An invention, meaning not received tradition.
Exactly. He argued it lacked that authentic oral transmission, you know, the person-to-person chain. He believed it was based on foreign beliefs or just personal speculations dressed up as divine revelation.
Okay, here's where it gets really interesting, I think. The specific texts being criticized.
Right. The source explicitly names the Zohar and its concept of parts of Fim as being central to this new foreign Kabbalah.
And it claims that Moses de Leon and his colleagues actually wrote and spread the Zohar.
Yes, and deceptively attributed it to the ancient sage Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai, Rashbi.
Wow. And there's another text mentioned, too.
Also, the Sefer Shur Koma, which the source says was falsely attributed to another ancient authority, Rabbi Ishmael.
So the core argument from Rash Bash, which Shalov echoes, is that these ideas just have no real link to the Torah of Moses or to the tradition of the sages, Shazal.
Precisely. No connection to the foundational bedrock of traditional Jewish thought and law.
Which brings us to the word Kabbalah itself. That means received tradition, right? So using that name seems significant.
Highly significant. The implication was clearly that these were secret divinely transmitted teachings. But the Rash Bash had a powerful counter to that.
What was his argument?
He said, look, true Kabbalah, genuine received mystical knowledge, is passed strictly from mouth to ear, and only to a specific kind of person.
Yeah.
A great, wise, and understanding individual.
Okay.
So he poses this question. If these were genuine secrets, how could the Kabbalists err by writing it in books to mislead people? Why commit such a fundamental error?
And why is writing it down seen as an error? Is it just about secrecy?
It's deeper than that. The source connects it to the prohibition against publicly discussing the most profound mystical subjects, like the Masa Merkava, the divine chariot vision.
Because it's dangerous territory.
Extremely. Tradition warns that discussing these things openly could easily lead to heresy and confusion, especially for those not properly prepared.
So the Rash Bash's point is?
His point is twofold. If these teachings are the supernal secrets, like Ma'asim Merkava, writing them down publicly is a major violation. But if they are not Ma'asim Merkava, if they don't come from that authentic restricted chain of transmission, then they're just Sfara.
Sfara, meaning?
Human speculation, logical deduction perhaps, but not divinely receives wisdom. And if it's just Sfara, it cannot, by definition, be called Kabbalah.
Okay, that's a fundamental challenge to the very label. Now let's get to the core concept, the Sephiro. The Rash Bash claims the new Kabbalists don't know what they are. That's quite an accusation.
It is. He basically takes apart the possible explanations for what these Sephiroth could be. He considers three options. First, their attributes of God.
Like God's characteristics?
Sort of. But Rash Bash asks, okay, if they're attributes, why are these 10 Sephiroth different from the 13 attributes of mercy God himself revealed to Moses?
Right.
And if these new ones are somehow better or more profound, why would God hide them from Moses, his greatest prophet? It doesn't make sense from a traditional perspective.
But he uses an analogy, right?
Yes, a classic Talmudic saying. Mm-hmm. If Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi, compiler of the Mishnah, didn't teach it, where did Rabbi Chaya, his student, get it? It implies a break in the authentic chain of tradition. It suggests a foreign source.
So this wasn't just some minor theological point. It was about God's very nature.
Absolutely. It touches on the core of divine unity in Judaism. Okay, so if they're not attributes, what's the second possibility Rash Bash considers?
Names.
Right, names of God. But he argues if they're just names, they aren't divine essences. However, if the new Kabbalists claim they are essences,
then you have a problem with God's unity.
Exactly. Rash Bash draws a stark comparison. He says, well, if Christians talk about threes, the Trinity, these new Kabbalists are talking about tens with their Sephiroth. It introduces multiplicity where there should be absolute unity, a very serious charge.
Okay, so not attributes, not names considered as essences. What's the third option?
The third is that maybe the Sephiroth are emanations or influences, like divine powers or maybe even angelic forces.
And the problem there?
The problem arises with prayer and intention. If you direct your prayers or focus your intent towards the Sephiroth as if they are independent essences, well, that's heresy. That's
because you're treating something other than God as divine.
Precisely. You're implying an essence apart from the creator himself. The Rash Bash is adamant. Believing in any essence other than God alone is heresy.
Wow. So across the board, he finds the concept theologically problematic, however you interpret it. This really is a fundamental debate about understanding God.
It is. And according to Sholoff's article, these new Kabbalists didn't stop there. They went further. They started calling their teachings wisdom of truth or inner wisdom.
And how did they position that against traditional learning?
They directly contrasted it with the Mishnah and Talmud, the core texts of rabbinic Judaism, which they apparently called external wisdom.
External wisdom. That sounds dismissive.
It was meant to be. This wasn't just giving their ideas a fancy name. It was a radical attempt to reorder the hierarchy of Jewish knowledge, basically saying our stuff is the real deal, the deep truth, that other stuff. Superficial.
And there were consequences for not engaging with their inner wisdom.
Oh, yes. The source says they frightened and warned people. They claimed that not studying their wisdom of truth would lead to divine punishment.
Using fear to elevate their own teachings.
It seems so. Yeah. And this leads to some of the most deeply controversial claims highlighted in the article. First, this idea of a distorted view of God.
How so?
Allegedly, these new Kabbalists claim that things like exile and suffering weren't just, consequences or trials. Mm. They were supposedly for clarifications, tres, and corrections.
Corrections. Corrections to what?
Corrections to God, essentially. To make God one and complete.
Wait, implying God isn't complete.
Exactly. That God is somehow incomplete, maybe even dependent on lowly humans and affected by humans and their actions in this cosmic drama of correction.
That sounds radically different from traditional views.
Radically different. Shalov's article condemns this, fiercely calls it blasphemy, scandal, heresy. It directly contradicts the very first of Maimonides' 13 principles of faith, that God is absolutely perfect, complete, and needs nothing from creation.
So a fundamentally different concept of God and also a different view of Torah study itself.
Absolutely. They apparently asserted that only by studying their wisdom of truth could redemption be hastened.
Meaning traditional study, Torah, Mishnah, Talmud wasn't enough?
Worse than not enough. They called it external and essentially insufficient. Shalov calls this view a wild incitement against the Torah of Moses.
And then there's the direct condemnation of the sages themselves. This seems almost unbelievable.
It's quite shocking. The article points to a specific text, Ifo Shalama, one of these new Kabbalistic works. It apparently misquotes a verse from the prophet Malachi.
Misquotes how? To what end?
It takes Malachi chapter 3, verses 18-22, and allegedly manipulates it. The source says the Kabbalist text deliberately omits a key part of a verse.
Okay.
To make it seem like the prophet is saying that those who study only the revealed Torah, meaning the Mishnah and Talmud, are not serving God, And worse, that they are wicked.
Wicked, the Talmudic sages.
That's the implication presented in the article. Shaloff is clearly incensed by this interpretation.
Just try to grasp the implications here. You're effectively labeling generations of revered Talmudic scholars, the foundation of normative Judaism, as wicked, as the cause for the length of exile.
It goes further. It suggests they aren't even truly wise, just mere students, compared to the practitioners of this supposed inner wisdom.
It's staggering, and there are consequences predicted for them, too.
According to the interpretation presented, yes. These Kabbalists supposedly claim that those who only study Talmud and Mishnah will be burned in the resurrection. They'll be called arrogant, doers of wickedness.
Burned.
And even become ashes under the feet of the new Kabbalists. It's a truly chilling condemnation, a direct assault on the entire rabbinic tradition.
And how does the article counter this interpretation of Malachi?
It contrasts it sharply with the actual conclusion of that very passage in Malachi, which is a call to remember the Torah of Moses, my servant, emphasizing that true Torah includes both the written and the oral law, passed down through a structured, authentic tradition, not invented speculations.
So bringing it back to the Rashbash himself, what were his final warnings on this whole matter?
He reiterated his deep concern. He observed in his time many ignoramuses boasting about their supposed Kabbalistic knowledge while actually being empty of wisdom and walking in complete darkness.
He saw it as a dangerous trend of false expertise.
Yes. And he didn't mince words about the consequences. He stated very clearly that those who speak of Sephiro and invented this thing from their minds, his words will pay for it.
A stark warning indeed.
It is. And his final advice was unequivocal. Anyone wanting to save their soul should stay far, far away from these new Kabbalists and their new Kabbalah.
Mm.
He called it explicitly foreign to pure Judaism.
He used some strong imagery too, didn't he?
Very strong. He likened choosing this path to someone wanting to lie or even wanting to hang themselves from a tall tree. It shows the extreme spiritual danger he perceived in these teachings.
We've certainly taken a fascinating and perhaps unsettling deep dive here. It's more than just theological disagreement. It raises these profound questions about, well, intellectual humility, how tradition is preserved, and what authentic knowledge really looks like.
Definitely. And I think understanding these historical debates gives you a kind of shortcut to grasping the complex dance between innovation and tradition in religious thought. You see how challenges to establish norms can arise, even from within.
So for you, our listener, maybe this prompts a question. In our own search for knowledge, whatever the field, how do we tell the difference between authentic tradition and novel interpretations, especially when labels like deep or secret or inner wisdom sound so compelling?
Right. How do we avoid the trap of, you know, dismissing solid foundational knowledge just because something newer claims to be more profound?
How do we figure out what truly constitutes deep knowledge, and how do we stay grounded, avoiding the dismissal of established wisdom just because something new comes along claiming superiority? Something to think about.